the Access the Inaccessible podcast from Patzel, with your host, Neil Gresham.
Hello and welcome to the third in the series of the Petzl Access the Inaccessible podcast. I'm the host, Neil Gresham, and in the first two episodes, I spoke to Tim Emmett and Anna Taylor. There's been a bit of a theme going on with these podcasts. My guests are colourful characters who are accomplished climbers, but who've got plenty of other things going on as well. And on that note, I'd like to introduce to you the guest for this show, a very good friend of mine who I've climbed and travelled with extensively, Saeed Belhaj. Welcome, Saeed.
Thank you very much. Sorry about the voice.
we're both a bit croaky, aren't we? Because, do you want to explain where we are?
Yeah, so right now we're in this really old house building that's called Evia Folkets Hus. We are in the heart of Bohuslän. And for the last couple of days, we've hosted the Bohusfest, which is the Bohuslän climbing and music festival. And yeah, yesterday night was quite rough, and as you can tell.
Yeah. We're going to come back to that in a minute. Wow. I mean, I've certainly had an amazing time at this festival. It's been so good to catch up with friends and get into the granite here. But I'm sure many of you listening will know Saeed, and he needs very little introduction. But I'll get the boring part. I'll get the stats out the way quickly. I mean, Saeed is red pointed to a pretty high level, having climbed Papachulo 9A+. He's kind of, I always think of you, Saeed, as more the sort of the on-site king, because I just think of you at the Petzl rock trips, like knocking out 8A+, 8B on-site, like day long with, you know, climbing with people like Steve McClure. And I mean, at the top end, you've on-sited either 5 or 6 8B pluses, depending on the grades that are accepted for one of them.
Yeah, that was a high standard back in the day.
This is the thing, you've been knocking this stuff out for a while. And but you're not just a sport climber, you know, you climbed trad and, like, in particular put up new routes. So super all-round guy. But really, climbing is just, I think you'd probably describe it as like one of your two main passions, and your other passion being music seems to hold an equal place for you. And I don't know how many, you probably lost count of how many hard routes you've done. Have you lost count of how many instruments you can play? And more to the point, like, these instruments that Saeed plays, they're not like conventional instruments. I don't recognize half of them. I mean, you introduced my presentation on a didgeridoo here at the Bohusfest. And there are all these kind of like ethnic sort of stringy, bangy sort of things. And like, how many of them are there?
Well, it depends on how you count it. I mean, there are instruments that I would perform with live, and there are certain instruments that I certainly would not go on stage with, like the violin, for instance, that I played quite a lot for at least 10 years, but I would never do a violin solo, but I could play for you maybe if things got really romantic. But yeah, apart from that, and also because I play so many different drums, how do you categorize that?
Yeah.
Is that just one instrument in total? Is it like 10 or 20? I don't know.
Yeah.
And then there are all these string instruments from North and West Africa. But yeah, I have a big warehouse that's full with climbing gear and instruments. That's all I can say.
I mean, for me, the challenge is knowing how to structure this, even though, of course, I've got some notes in front of me. There's just so many things I want to talk to you about, and they all seem to relate to each other. And in particular, I think a lot of people here listening would think, oh, well, climbing, that's one thing. Music, that's a completely different thing. But you seem to have like woven the two together in your life. And I mean, I first came up against you on one of the Petzl rock trips when in Turkey, when you were like, you know, out climbing all day, and then like we'd have these big parties in the evening, and you were the kind of, I suppose, the sort of kingpin or like master of ceremonies, you know, bringing out all these instruments and just really like rallying the crowd and like raising the spirit and getting the vibe going. I mean, I suppose for you, those Petzl rock trips must have been almost like the ultimate, because you do get to combine both these things.
It was a good combo, absolutely.
But then I suppose also when you travel, because you're interested in, like, I mean, the music that you're interested in is various different, a lot of it comes from different regions, different countries. And you, I guess you've kind of made journeys to actually like be with those communities, haven't you? I see this on your social media quite a lot.
Yeah, you know, for me, climbing, first of all, was and still is so much about traveling. But for me, it wouldn't really make as big of a sense if I would travel that far just to go climbing, you know, that route or in that area, because there's so much else going on. And of course, climbing is a perfect way to connect with a community that you didn't know. It's like a shortcut into a new place. But the same thing is with music.
With music,
you know, if you play or you're interested in that particular style, you're not as much of a tourist anymore, because you have a common language straight away. And with music, especially when it's more traditional music or, you know, folk music, it comes with a tradition. The music is maybe in the center of the tradition, but there's so much more going on. So if you at least try to understand what that music is, you will get a lot of other things as a bonus. And maybe, hopefully, you can more understand where you actually are, more than just grabbing that crimp or two-finger pocket or tufa. So, you know, music and also climbing could be this, but climbing, at least as far as it goes mainstream, has become quite narrow and boring in my opinion. But music still has a different, a much more free spirit, I would say. But of course, climbing still has those other things, but we might come into these topics later on.
I think so. I mean, you've certainly, you know, here we are at the Boislem Festival, and you've certainly stamped your mark on that, because I'd say that the live music was as much a part of this event as the climbing, and everybody got that straight away at a glance and really rose to the occasion. And it really meant that, you know, you got off the crag, and it wasn't just a case of, oh, you know, cook some pasta, watch you, you know, wait for your arms to recover, go to bed and climb again. It was like, oh, right, now actually things are going to go up a level, because, you know, there was different types of music at the same time. There was a live band in the main area. There'd be a DJ outside, and it was all kind of rotating around, and different people were jamming with each other. And it was, you kept us on our toes. It was, from my perspective as a, you know, somewhat like someone who was on the dance floor, it was very exciting. But let's, I think now, get in a bit deeper, because I want to talk to you about the Boislem Festival more specifically, and like, why? I mean, where did the idea come from, and why a festival? Because, okay, let me start off. Let me challenge you and be devil's advocate. Like, climbers have mixed views about festivals. Some people love them, some people hate them. I mean, I think I'm one of these people who can't make up my mind. Don't get me wrong, I absolutely loved this festival. But sometimes when I hear about a festival, I think, oh no, you know, the crowd's going to be really busy. You're not going to be able to park. You're not going to be able to get on routes. Like, why would you want to do that? Shouldn't climbing just be more, isn't it better when it's more a wilderness experience when you're the only people on the crag? But I don't know. Anyway, I don't think that about this festival, because, as I say, I've had an amazing time. But like, what was, I mean, I'd love to know your motivation for doing it, because also I've seen the incredible amount of work you've put in, and also like the financial risk that you take. I mean, if you don't get many takers, you know, and also it's been incredibly cheap for climbers, you know, it's a risk. But anyway, sorry, I'm talking too much. You tell me.
Well, it all started during COVID, when I was kind of stuck in Sweden, and I developed all these new crags. I think there were 5 or 6 new crags, but because I hadn't really solved the parking situation and the trails, etc., I sort of kept those places a little bit secret. And I didn't want people to just come there and start climbing here and there. Routes that were not finished. Some holes would break. Some rocks would fall into someone's head.
Yeah.
So I kept quite low profile. I just invited some close friends who helped me out a little bit. But then when it was time to sort of open up all these places, I thought, yeah, but it would be quite boring to just put it on 27 crags or whatever. And that would be it. So we should celebrate. And when it comes to Sweden and the climbers especially, it's quite hard to get people together. It's quite hard to see people. You have to really have to have a really strong reason to meet. So I thought, okay, let's have a meeting and see what happens. And, you know, I have a pretty long experience with organizing different events in music, especially. And you mentioned the rock trip. I've been a part of that for 20 years or more, and I had some experience and some ideas of how this could be done. And I mean, one thing that was really important was that it shouldn't just be for climbers, because that's too boring, I think, personally. There should be other people coming, and especially the locals, because when it comes to access, potential access issues, I thought, but it's good if climbers and non-climbers from the region could get together, and so they could see what climbing is, and they could meet climbers, you know, in a more relaxed environment. So, I mean, it's a no-brainer to mix climbing with music in a way, but you have to know how to do it.
Yeah.
Anyone can bring a DJ or a live band, but you have to know how to build a nice evening. What time should be, you know, when should you have this? What time should you have that? And I think that comes with experience and see how people act generally. So that was the first year that we did the festival, and it was such a... I mean, it's a small, I don't even know if you could call it a festival at this point, because it's such a small gathering. But
200 people.
Yeah, we were almost 250, 270 yesterday night here. And again, it's a small festival, and that's the way it should be, because it stays and becomes intimate, and you can actually connect with people. It's not just an ocean of people all over the place, but, you can... It's a different thing to have it in this size. But anyway, the first year was so successful, so I thought, okay, let's give it a go another time. And now it's the third year. And because you learn along the way, I never did this kind of festival before, because if you do something with music, it's fairly easy. You just need to deal with drunk people eventually or other things. But here you also have climbing, which includes safety, other types of logistics. And you have to build a nice evening that doesn't become too boring, but there should be something that's a little bit informative with lectures and things like that. So yeah, it's a hard balance to strike. But I think we've found a pretty good formula at this point.
Yeah, I mean, there was one presentation each evening, and I did one of them. And I quite like the way that you booted me off the stage after 45 minutes. Certainly no one's ever done that to me before. But like, I totally understood the sentiment of it. Because as we keep saying, you can... chat on about climbing forever, can't you?
Yeah.
And people can get too much of that, especially if they've been out during the day. You know, it's time to change the channel.
Yeah. No, I've seen too many presentations in the evening that go on. I mean, I could have listened to, and many also said that Neil should have spoken for 3 hours. But it is a Friday evening,
people
and there's a certain time when you're going to sit and listen, but there's also a time when people want to start moving around. And you don't necessarily do that to a lecture.
And you had these amazing professional musicians who've turned up. I mean, we want to get some time out of those
guys, don't we? Yeah. And because it's a climbing festival, we're not in Spain. There are not lots of drugs involved here, apart from alcohol and maybe coffee. We don't want to keep going out till 5-6 in the morning. Yeah. I want to be done, you know, at 1 or 2 in the morning, so people can get up at 9 or 10 and still have a pretty good climbing day.
Well, that's the thing. I felt just about able to function and climb the next day. So it definitely felt like you got the best from both worlds. And the other thing is that I think Boerslen is as a climbing area, there's lots of small crags all spread out. And I think that the crowds kind of dissipated. I mean, the crags didn't feel super busy to me. People were all going to different places. And also, you know, I mean, one of the things that came out of the... You hosted this morning a discussion about like access to the crag and how we can sort of manage ecological issues. And one of the things that was discussed was the importance of not all just going to the honeypot crags, like the most obvious crags, like encouraging people to try new crags. And I think that's really what people were doing at this event. So you're setting a good precedent there by spreading that message. Yeah, I mean, overall, I feel that... it makes you think why there aren't more of these types of events. I think there's still a bit of a post-COVID thing going on where everybody, when they, you know, get together or feel a real sense of, there was just a really high-spirited atmosphere, wasn't there?
Absolutely. I was very happy with this. I was really happy with this event. I mean, again, financially, it's not that you get rich, but to see people happy and together, I mean, that's the biggest reward for me anyways. And also, it's so much about, it's like with New Root Development, it's about giving something back to the community, because climbing gave us so much in our lives. So how can you give something back? I think if an event like this is a perfect way.
Yeah, you it really did. I felt that you really did show people a good time here, and I think it was a real celebration of climbing. But I was quite surprised because I thought we were going to see more people coming out from the gyms in Gothenburg, like, you know, indoor climbers who are perhaps going to check out the crags for the first time, and, you know, maybe because there were clinics for beginners, it was a great opportunity for people to learn. But in fact, I sensed that it was mainly like more experienced climbers here. I was quite surprised that there weren't more gym climbers here. What was your take on that?
Yeah, it's true, and it's too bad. And, you know, I always try to encourage so-called gym climbers to get out, because if you look at Gothenburg as an example, or even Stockholm, you know, you can take the local bus for 15 minutes and then you have 500 routes in Utby, for instance, which is a great climbing area just close to the city. It has bouldering, trad climbing, sport climbing. But it seems quite difficult for them to make this transition. And I also thought that maybe a festival could help, because at least music is not that difficult. And they say, okay, well, this is a good opportunity to get out there. But I don't know. It's a hard one to crack. And it's not just this festival that has failed to bring those gym
for
rats
sure.
out.
This is right across the board. We're hearing this far and wide.
Yeah. And but
it's hard to explain, as you say, and a difficult nut to crack.
Yeah. But it is what it is. And as everyone knows, you know, indoor climbing has become a thing of its own. And those people don't necessarily identify themselves with rock climbing, or, you know,
no.
They don't look at themselves as climbers in that way. Maybe there's a poster from a remote place in the gym of someone climbing, you know, some famous person, and they just, for them, it's like a different planet almost, because they don't see themselves ever going there.
Yeah, for sure. I think the other thing that I really came out of the festival was people were motivated to push their climbing. I think when you get groups of people, I've noticed this before in coaching, and I certainly noticed this in my clinic, like, the safety in numbers, and you look around and you see other people like pushing it, maybe taking some falls. I guess I'm talking, well, about sport climbing and trad climbing, because a lot of climbers are not happy about falling off in either of those environments, but especially in trad climbing. And yeah. But you know, the thing I was so impressed with during my clinic was the number of people who said, right, you know, I'm here, I'm going to take the opportunity, you know, I'm not going to say take, I'm going to go for it. And right. like quite a few people did like personal best and were really pleased with that. I mean, I've got to say, I don't even so much put it down to the specifics of my coaching. I think it's much more about that kind of shared energy. And I, sure. you know, I've seen this before so many times when I've run group sessions in like Kalymnos or wherever. And there was a lot of that going on. And I felt I was really impressed with the standard of the trad climbing, the number of people who are trad climbing, the number of people who, you know, booked onto my workshop, which was not a beginner's workshop. It was for people who very much knew the ropes and wanted to take it to the next level. Because we, you know, there's this thing we're saying in the UK at the moment that it feels like there's less people out trad climbing than there was 20 years ago, like when I started, because there are now alternatives. I mean, we've just mentioned gym climbing, but in particular, bouldering, you know, and sport climbing have these disciplines like stolen trad climbing's lunch almost, you know. But here I felt that trad climbing was strong and thriving. And, you know, when you have those conversations in the morning, you say to people, oh, you know, what are you going to do today? Where are you going? And I almost expected people to say, oh, I'm going sport climbing. But they were like, no, I'm going trad climbing. So it was strong.
Yeah, there was a pretty big renaissance for trad climbing here in Sweden and here in Bohuslän in particular, maybe five to 10 years ago. I mean, but there were also many years in Bohuslän when there was no one. You know, when I started coming up here, maybe 30 years ago, there was no one climbing here. But trad climbing generally was much bigger because that was the only thing you could do.
That was how it started, rather like in the UK.
Right. Yeah. But and then, you know, sport climbing came in and I don't know what happened to those so-called trad climbers. But yeah, there's a big renaissance and I think people are really curious. And the obvious reason is because you come to a beautiful place like Bohuslän and you see these cracks, you just realize that, yeah, but, you know, I have to learn this craft and art to be able to climb these lines.
Yeah.
That's the only way to do it. So more and more climbers are becoming versatile, although there's another part of the climbing world where people are becoming even more specialized and stay indoors. But if you're a climber living in Sweden and you don't climb trad, man, you're going to miss out of, you know, 70% of the best roots here. And yeah, more and more people are realizing this.
I mean, let's not get bogged down with the sort of politics of the Swedish scene. I mean, I know there's been, like, you know, bits of friction over the years between, like, the protagonists, people putting up new routes and so on. And I think, like, sometimes you almost get tagged as a sport climber, because is it true to say that most of the new routes you put up are sport routes? But or at least you've developed entire sport crags, but you're just as likely to go out trad climbing, aren't you? I mean, you're someone who enjoys both and doesn't have one particular allegiance.
No, I mean, I don't make any difference in different genres of climbing. You know, you come to a place and you look at it, okay, how can I protect this climb? Do I need to place gear? Is it one pitch or several? Is it a boulder? Okay, let's bring out those pads. I need to put a bolt here. Is it a mixed climb?
Yeah.
It's, you know, because when I started climbing, you know, there was no such thing as a sport climber or a trad climber. I had no idea. It was just climbing.
Just climbing.
And that was it. And different routes and places, they lent themselves to different ways. And that was completely natural to me. So there's never been a us and them, in my opinion. Although some people might have try to create this kind of tension, which I think is completely ridiculous. But anyway, I
think that you also, I mean, you have the context of the fact that you've traveled so extensively and climbed all over the world. And I think, I certainly feel exactly the same way. It's like, it's all climbing and it's all good. And I think it's just a lot of it boils down to, like, aesthetics, like doing the right thing by this particular line, you know, and having that strong feeling about whether this would be best as a trad climb or a sport climb. And, like, sometimes you're going to get that wrong. I mean, we were talking about that route, Electric Avenue, which started off with a few bolts in it. The bolts got taken out, and the general consensus was that it was a better route for that. But, you know, it's a very hard thing to sort of, how could you describe this to, a non-climber, but it's actually quite a hard thing to describe, even to people who don't put up new routes. You know, like, I learned the craft by traveling extensively in, like, you know, Brazil, Mongolia, Vietnam, Cuba, China, and so on. And you know, you rock up at these particular areas with an open mind. First of all, you see what the locals are doing and you want to be respectful of that. But in many incidences, I've found this, and I know the same for you, you're first on the scene and there is no local climbing scene. You know, you're on this untouched rock and you think, well, what's going to be the best style here? You know, we've got the drill with us, but maybe we're going to go trad this time. Or you think, this would make a better sport cliff. And you make that call, don't you? And I think that really that leads us on to the next. So, I mean, unless there's more you wanted to add about the Boislem Festival, I mean...
No, that's fine.
I wanted to move on to just talk to you about new routing, because
sure,
you're someone who's always been passionate about developing, you know, new climbs. You've been doing this for a long time now, but it seems like you've really upped the ante in the last couple of years and you've been banging out loads of high-quality new stuff. I emphasise quality. Like, you're not one of these guys who's just, like, going for volume. You're looking for, like, really cool stuff, but you've been in, like, over 10 countries in the last year or two and developing bouldering areas as well as sport climbing and trad climbing. Like, I know in Morocco, and, well, could you list some of the countries?
Well, in the last year, it's been Ireland, Turkey, Georgia, Armenia, Greece, Morocco, Montenegro, Albania, Finland, Norway. Yeah, I think
and new stuff in all those countries.
Yeah, new routes or boulders. Yeah.
I'm surprised you can keep tabs on it. I mean, so how did it work out? Like, that you would go to all those different places? I mean, do you have a plan beforehand that you're going to go to all those venues, or do you go to one and then you just find some motivation, or you meet some climbers, or something happens and you decide to go? Do you just take each venue one at a time, or is there a longer term plan with it?
No, they're almost all individual trips. And as you can tell, I mean, these places, except maybe Ireland or Sweden or Norway or Finland, they're not really on the mainstream climbing radar. And that's why I like to go to these types of places, because first of all, there's usually there's always some kind of community.
Yeah.
There's always some climber there. It doesn't matter. You mentioned Brazil and China and Mongolia. Some person has climbed there somehow.
Sure.
Even if it's not the
way. Especially now. But especially when we were doing those trips like sort of 15, 20 years ago.
But
like,
still.
Yeah, but still someone would have been there.
Someone has climbed
sure,
there.
For sure.
Someone went up there somehow. Even if it's not the way we think about climbing. So there would be someone there. Somehow.
Some weird old like chipped holds or like rusty bolts.
Could be anything. Could be anything. Or someone's been climbing up there to get whatever reason. And it's always interesting to connect with that kind of community when it's sort of fresh and new and curious. Because, you know, I spent a lot of time in places where climbing is quite established. And both the climbing communities sometimes, but also the other people, they're not that keen on having foreigners there. And especially not trying to take put up some nice new lines instead of looking at it as, oh, wow, here comes someone who's trying to help the community here, who's trying to create something. They can look at it a different way. But if it's a fresh new community, they love it. I guess the only thing that I don't like as much is when, you know, they tell you, you have to try our hardest route, even if it's the biggest pile of shit they have, just because it's a hard number. And of course, they want to see, where are we at? What's the level? But anyways, if you come to these types of places, there's usually quite a big selection of unclimbed lines. And this is, you know, how it is. It's like a smorgasbord, I guess you say in English. You come there, you can just pick and choose.
Yeah.
I mean, can you do that in Spain somewhere? Yeah, you have to walk quite far to find any king lines like that, that are unclimbed. And, you know, you have different phases in your life as a climber. For me, for many years, climbing on site was the only thing I really cared about. There was a time for competition. There was a time when I had a personal renaissance with trad climbing, et cetera, et cetera. But now it's really been all about new routes, because I don't really have any established routes that I know of that I really want to do, to be honest. I did so many in my life. So then you have to put up your own instead.
And it's an amazing creative process as well, isn't it? And that must sort of almost like sort of tally with the same mindset as you have for music.
Yeah, because also what I could say is my first routes that I ever did, they were my own routes, because there was no climbing where I started climbing. So if you have that in your background, you always tend to look for these things anywhere you go. And of course, sometimes you do it more or less, but what I can say here in Bohuslän, for instance, where there is so much potential, most people don't put up new routes, or even if it's in their backyard, because they don't have this mindset. But if you have it, it's almost like an obsession. You have to do it. If you see something unclimbed, you have to try it.
This might be a strange question, but like, I mean, I sort of did your resume at the start when I spoke about 9A+ and, you know, on-siting numerous 8B+s. And now we're talking about your new routes. Like, if you were forced to choose, or like if I asked you which was the most important, like if you had to imagine that you'd only done one of those things, would it be the new routes? Would it be 9A+, or would it be a bunch of 8B+ on sites?
I think,
or is that like asking you to choose between the didgeridoo and the drums?
That's fine. I think still climbing on site in your limit, and this might sound super cheesy and cliche, but it's the most spiritual part of rock climbing, the way I see it, because you enter a state of mind that's so far from, and I'm sure alpinists would say the same thing. If you do something dangerous, you're in a very special zone in your mind that you would never even touch, not even be close in everyday life. But, you know, climbing on site is sort of an adventure in your mind, because you're pushing yourself physically. And you, why is it an adventure? It's because you don't know what's coming, you know.
People underestimate this. People think sport climbing, bolts, that's not an adventure. But it so is. You know, we become so obsessed with knowing everything, like in all aspects of our life. We don't like uncertainty, do we? And so many people in climbing now are defaulting to project climbing. So they know the hole, they know where they're going to be able to clip from, they know the sequence. And it is like the unknown is stressful, even in a sport climbing situation. And when you're dealing with, you know, intense fatigue as well, Yeah, you do get into that heightened state. I know what you mean.
Yeah, I was just feeling really free climbing on site, you know, because there was, I had no idea what I was doing. At the same time, as you said, I mean, one thing is not better than the other in the end. Projecting something, it has a different aspect that's really interesting and puts you in a different state of mind in a way, because you know exactly what's going to happen. Yeah. And it's so much about doing it perfectly.
Yeah.
And you have the same thing in music, you know, if you play improvised music or if you try to play something really difficult that you've rehearsed many, 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 many times. Are you going to nail it this time, or you or someone else going to fuck it up at some point?
Yeah,
probably, because it's so difficult. And that's the whole point in a way. So but anyway, I think for me, what fits my personality the best in the end would be on-site climbing. Although,
right,
I haven't done much on-site climbing in the last couple of years in comparison to what I used to do.
Because as you say, climbing goes in these sort of phases and chapters, or at least it has done for you. And I that's exactly how it's been for me too. Mm. But the other thing that interested me was like listening to you talk about the jamming session last night on the dance floor and between you and the band members, and how you feel like a team and it's about getting the most out of each other. And I feel like you have an ability to do this with the people who you climb with, because I feel like I climb well in your company, and, you know, because you're quite encouraging and you know, what does that come from? Is that just you as a person? Is that something that's come from your travel, or?
I don't know. At least encouraging someone in climbing is important. Otherwise, climbing is too boring. Mm. Am I just going to stand there and belay? It's a teamwork in the end. And I was talking about it quite a lot in my clinic yesterday. But, you know, it really is about sharing that experience.
That's what I was trying to get at. I didn't ask the question very well, but there's something that you seem to dial into that I think a lot of climbers are quite inward looking, and it's about what they can get out of the day on the crag, and they're thinking about their performance and the grades that they want to do. Sure, they've got to like communicate with the belayer, you know, they don't want to be like a super selfish climbing partner, or they're not going to end up with many partners. But you know, like you just seem to have this knack for like kind of getting everybody psyched up, and you know, and again, I noticed you doing that on the Petzl Rock trips, whereas others were, you could see, were just more focused on their own game. But you're kind of thinking about what other people are doing as well.
Yeah, because it's not always that you have the perfect climbing day yourself.
Yeah.
So you have to open up your perspective and see what else is happening here.
Sure.
It's not only me climbing here. How can I have a good climbing day anyway? Well, if you're climbing well this today, I mean, that's great. I'm happy for you.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a shared energy. And at the same time, I love being outside clogging on my own on a project, or being up bouldering on my own. That's a different thing. But if we're going to climb together, we're really going to climb together. It's not like just me belaying you. That sounds fucking boring to me.
That's it. You nailed it. There was something there, and that's what I was trying to draw out. Yeah, for sure. I feel it's not as that mindset and that kind of sharing sort of spirit isn't as common as you might hope in climbing. you know, it's
I'm not
saying you don't see it. I'm not saying you're not the only person who does this, but you don't always come across it.
Yeah, I mean, what really inspired me when I was younger was when I came to Spain, because there it was a lot about this more than anywhere else. It was really a shared energy.
Yeah, yeah.
And we certainly didn't have that in Sweden in that same way. And when you come to a place like that, you say, wow, I like this. This is what I want. This is what I want to create.
Yeah.
So you pass that on.
Yeah, no doubt.
Mm.
Okay, so the other thing I wanted to talk about was the kind of the lifestyle of I bet you hate this term professional climber. I'm not a fan of it, but you know, but probably people would call you one of those, and some would probably think I was one as well. But, you know, like there's this kind of myth that it's this sort of perfect existence and you just get paid to go climbing all the time, and life, especially when we look at people's social media, you know, it just doesn't. You see all the sort of top superhero climbers, and you think that it's they're living the dream. But, you know, I know, because you say this to me all the time, how grateful you are for the life that you had and how you do feel like really sort of privileged to have done what you've done. But at the same time, there are challenges and there are compromises that you have to make. I mean, I'm going to start off by talking about unit number 278 in the green storage facility in Gothenburg.
Oh,
when I got off the plane, like Saeed took me to his lockup, and this it's one of these like it's called the green storage. In the UK, they call them the yellow storage. You know,
you
go in there, and it's just like this really kind of it's like a sort of somber warehouse.
It's like a jail,
you know?
Man.
It's like a jail. You go and you go in there and you find number 278 and then you unlock the door and it's like jammed full of haul bags, isn't it? And in your case, loads of like weird looking instruments down jackets and all this shit just falls out of it and you have to like empty it in order to find that rucksack that's right at the very back.
But where I'm
going with this is that so he doesn't actually have anywhere else. Like, that's it.
If they didn't close that at night, I would have probably slept in that warehouse.
You would have slept
mind
in
you.
It. So you're basically, you've got a car and you've got a storage lockup and you're kind of on the move, right? And you know, you're 42. I mean, I'm exactly 10 years older than you. I mean, I'm definitely old. I wouldn't describe you as old, but I certainly wouldn't describe you as young either. And you know, I mean, sometimes... Do you feel the pinch a little bit? Do you sort of think, what am I doing here? Is this not more like what the young crew are doing? I mean...
Yeah, I mean, I always said that... I always tell my friends, if I'm still homeless and unemployed when I'm 50, it's so... You could give me a little, you know, nod or a hint. Okay, maybe it's good to change a few things in your life, but... I mean, it's both, as we say, it's both a blessing and a curse,
and a curse.
At the same time. But somehow, you know, in the same way as, you know, being in a dark dungeon in Sheffield training and living, everything's just terrible. You know, we somehow like it. We like it.
We like that.
Somehow, this struggle. We somehow,
so it's like suffering for your art, really, isn't
it? Yeah, it's you know, it's like the Bohemians in Paris, you know, back in the day, or, you know, whatever. It's, and of course, this sounds completely ridiculous, but it's some kind of a romantic idea about how we want to live our lives. And any lifestyle you choose will have a yin and yang. It's not just one way. It's not perfect. But I can say that for me, there was never any other option. Once I finished high school, it was like, ciao, I'm out of here.
And I want to climb.
Yeah, and I hit the road, and it's been like that for more than 20 years now. And there's nothing I regret. At the same time, if I would like to change, I could do that tomorrow. I'll move in with my mother and probably find a job and... you know, do all those things that you're supposed to do.
But it isn't well paid, is it? I mean, unless you're one of the like super top guys, you know, but most of the people who go on the Petzl Rock trips that we know, our friends, I mean, they're all climbing in the sort of nines, you know, but then they're not like rolling in money and driving around in flash cars, you know, they have to make, they make the choice. And it's like, yeah, if they want to make more money and top up their sponsorship, then they're going to be doing it essentially a full-time job like everyone else, you know?
Exactly.
So, you know, you have to live on a really tight budget, don't you? And I mean, hence your decision to actually not rent or own a property that you can actually live in.
Yeah.
But I think what I'm trying to draw out here also is the fact that perhaps I don't like to keep bringing up bloody social media, but like sometimes people go on like and think, oh, that guy, you know, I bet he's got it good. You know, why is he so lucky? That type of thing. But the point is, you've got to really love climbing to make those compromises. And you've also got to work really hard at it. You've got to train like all the time and you've got to set goals and you've got to go and achieve them. I mean, that's the situation. And that's why it's reciprocal, isn't it? And if you do that, then brands are going to want to work with you. The key with this is that you have to have a high level of passion for climbing to make those sacrifices. You can't be kind of like half-hearted about it or not really, you know, maybe you like it a bit or you train hard sometimes, but not all the time. It's like you've got to totally commit to it and make it your life. And this is something that you've done. And like, you've been a so-called pro climber for how many years now?
I think it's 20, 2 years now.
22 years. And you must have seen so many changes, like, over that period. How has it changed for you?
Well, it's changed dramatically. I mean, it was perfect when I started, you know. I mean, I don't even know where to start, but if we're going to talk about social media, for instance, when those things came, first I thought this is perfect, you know. It made things more democratic, if you like. Mm-hmm. Before, you had to be in a magazine, you had to be in a movie. Those were pretty big deals, you know, a movie production. Suddenly you could do that. You could do that on your own. You could, you know, write a blog, have some nice photos, etc., etc. And you thought, okay, but this is a good way to inspire people and have some kind of quality, in-depth stories or information. And then suddenly, one day I realized that what just happened? Is this what I write here or what I try to publish here more important than what's happening in real life? That's when I just sort of had enough of the whole thing. I still do it a little bit when I have something that I think could be interesting to share. But, I mean, climbing should always be about climbing, I think. And these things should not push you in one direction or the other.
It sounds like such an obvious thing to say.
Yeah, it's obvious. And for everyone, I mean, it is obvious.
But it isn't, you know, and we look at and we see so many, like, I think, you know, social media casualties. You can just tell that climbing is just the kind of vehicle that they're using to sort of increase their following and promote themselves online. And you can only imagine that they're just not having authentic experiences when they go out, because all they're thinking about is the content. And you know, we all feel these pressures. We all feel the need to sort of strike a balance. I mean, I don't think you or I work with brands that are saying to us, you know, you have to make this many posts a day or a week. I know you wouldn't last 5 minutes if that was in your contract. And I wouldn't either. And I mean, thankfully, we work for brands that just say, yeah, hey, you know, social media is important. We like it that you guys do it, but we're not going to, like, put you under this type of pressure. But nonetheless, we feel the pressure ourselves, don't we? Yeah. Or at least, you know, I have felt that pressure, but just chatting to you about this in the car on the way over, you've just said that you've gone past that now.
Yeah, because I've got nothing to lose. If a sponsor tells me you have to do this or that, I say, okay, go look for someone else. I couldn't care. Yeah. Seriously, couldn't care less.
Yeah. Yeah.
Someone would say, okay, well, what are you going to do then? Yeah, but I'm from Sweden with a pretty good social security. I'm not going to end up on the streets. If what I do is not valid enough, if that doesn't have enough value, doing everything that we've putting into climbing and what we've put on in the last 30 years, if Instagram is more important than that, sorry, man, you know.
Yeah, I agree.
All we can say is what really matters and what's real is the rock and that relationship we have. And of course, we try to be professional. We are not idiots. But it's a balance. And that should never take over and dictate what you should do and should not do, because then it's not genuine. And man, we grew up in a time where that was very, very different from this.
I know.
I mean, most of the time, even if there was a photo taken, it was once in a month, once in 6 months. Most of the days you were just climbing.
Just climbing.
Trying your best. There was no one filming or shooting. Nobody knew nothing. If someone knew that you had to climb a hard route, it was your friend told someone, or these just things just sort of spread organically. And it was paradise. You know, it's not just in climbing. You know, you travel to places and they're doing these ridiculous, these self-claimed reporters making these posts here and there. And I think it's a bit of a circus. But at the same time, there's nothing wrong with it.
No.
Per se. It's just, it's not for me. That's all I can say.
Me. And I mean, in a way, we end up becoming more like ambassadors of, like, authentic, real climbing experiences than ambassadors of brands. I mean, I think that I would hope that that's what the brands want us to do and want us to be, you know, just like spreading the simple message that the reason to go climbing is to kind of, you know, have adventure, push yourself, like, set yourself a challenge, do it and achieve it. Don't worry about, like, you know, spraying about it or, you know, how it's going to affect your followers.
And I think in the end, you know, all these things come and go, everything is a trend. But in the end, I think the best way, if we're talking about sponsorship, the best way to inspire people is in reality.
Yes, exactly.
If that is encouraging someone that you never met, giving him or her a belay, you have a festival, you gather people, you try to spread that. Nice. I think for me personally, that's the best you could do. But
to loop it back round, I couldn't.
But of course, internet is another great tool that could be used. But yeah. With moderation, I would say.
We'll leave it to the people who understand.
Yeah, and it's up to everyone, and there's no right or wrong, but we're all different, and that's fine, you know, it's okay.
Quite right. No, thanks for sharing that. So, okay, I mean, just really to conclude, I'm wondering what you're up to next.
I have no idea, and it's the first time that I say that in more than 20 years, maybe almost 30 years. There's been too much going on in the last 20, 30 years. And this is, I'm saying this seriously. I've been going so hard on my plans and my projects and my travels. We're talking 60 countries. I don't know how many hundreds of climbing areas. And I don't know how many projects and ideas, not just in climbing, you know, in music. I'm writing a book right now.
A book that's purely to do with music.
No, this has nothing. It's a novel for young people. It has nothing to do with music or climbing.
Or climbing, right?
It's just a fiction and a story.
I look forward
that to I hope that. Can inspire young people in this weird time that we're living in the Western world, at least. There has been so much going on. The only thing I know is that I'm celebrating my 30 years as a climber this year. So I'm going to have a big photo exhibition, and I will invite some of my great music masters from Morocco and Mali, for instance, and Stockholm. So that's the next big project for this year in terms of, organizing something. But when it comes to climbing, I really need to take a step back right now. When it comes to travel, I really need to take a step back. Because in the end, you and I were perfect in optimizing our time. Maybe you are even more so because you have a family. But after a while, when you do too much, in the end, you do nothing.
I agree, yeah.
There's too much going on in your head, in your life.
You can't take it in. You can't appreciate it.
You know, it's and even if you have these so-called perfect days, you know, I managed to squeeze that in, and then I did that and that and that and that, and in the end it's like, what's the point? So I'm maybe this, I don't know how this sounds, but I'm in a phase in the next couple of months where I need to take a step back and, you know, have a, you know, really look seriously at the next move. Because, you know, if you look back at your life, okay, these last 20 years they were perfect. Am I going to do the exact same thing in the next 20 years? Maybe not. Maybe there are a few things that could be changed slightly, because it's just not the same thing to be 42 as 25 or 18. It's just the way.
In my 20s and 30s, it was all purely fueled by the heart. There was no kind of, you know, I wasn't planning or being strategic. It was like, well, I want to go to this country and do this climb. And there was nothing more to it than that. But now I'm starting to think, well, you know, I haven't got forever. If I mess this next chapter up, you know, then I might not have a chance to do certain things. And you become really picky about what you go for.
Exactly. And it all boils down to quality in everything. Whether it's a new route, it has to be quality. Why go for quantity? It's just a waste of time.
Yeah.
Why do something, a festival, if it's not quality?
Yeah.
Why play music if it's not quality? That's all that counts for me right now. As you said, I mean, we're not 25 anymore. And this is what I'm trying to adapt to this new way of thinking, which is not always that easy when you've gone full throttle every day. And because of that, I need a bit of time to sort of meditate on these things before I take that next step. Because otherwise, it would be very easy to live the same way that you did when you were 25. And I don't want to be that person.
Yeah. Well, thanks. Thanks so much for sharing your thoughts and wisdom with us today, Saeed. I'm sure that everyone listening has taken quite a lot home from from the things that you've had to say. And, you know, like wishing you the very best of luck. And, you know, during this period of time out, I'm sure everyone's really looking forward to hearing about what you come up with next.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Saeed. And yeah, we'll see you here soon for the next episode of the Access the Inaccessible podcast. Cheerio.